when, you know, Black Lives Matter changes the conversation around policing and racial justice in this country, that actually has benefited now Native people because it's changed the conversation on, you know, the subject of Native mascots.
Welcome to Dear Culture, the podcast that gives you news you can trust for the culture. I'm Natasha S. Alford, Vice President of Digital Content at The Griot.
And I'm Marielle Turner, Senior Editor at The Griot. This week we are asking, Dear Culture, what's the power of a symbol?
Baseball is America's favorite pastime, or so the saying goes, but that's not exactly true, at least not in a literal sense. According to surveys of sports fans, actually, football is the most favored sport for Americans, and it's been that way for the last 40 plus years. But this upcoming football season, like everything this year, has been turned upside down. What can we even expect?
To be honest, we don't know. The NFL made a pledge back in March that the season would continue as planned as other sports leagues like the NBA and the NHL canceled their seasons. Some precautions are being taken for players, but they're still in training and some training rosters have been reduced. But still, much remains to be seen. But one thing we'll for sure be talking about this season has nothing to do with coronavirus.
That's right, Marielle. The Washington Redskins just last week announced that they would be retiring their name and mascot, which has been the topic of contention for decades. Native and indigenous activists have called the term Redskin, which I even hate to say right now, a racial slur, and they've called the team's logo offensive. Until recently, the organization has not been very receptive to these calls to change. Daniel Snyder, the team's owner, said he would never change the team's name. So, what changed?
Well, the decision came after mounting pressure from companies like Nike and FedEx and others threatening not to sell their merchandise and pulling ads. So basically, money talks. There's a lot to unpack here, and that is why we invited our guest today.
The fight to change the Washington Redskins name has been a long one. Our guest today is going to help put the team's recent announcement that they were changing their name into context. Julian Brave Noisecat is a correspondent for Real America with Jorge Ramos and a contributing editor at Canadian Geographic.
His writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, and the Paris Review. Earlier this month, he wrote a piece for The Undefeated called Do the Right Thing, Change the Name of the Washington's NFL Team, about his experience living in Washington, D.C. and his relationship with its mascot. Thanks for joining us, Julian. So you wrote this piece for The Undefeated earlier this month, making the case for the Washington Redskins to change their name. And in that piece, you mentioned that for a long time, you didn't like covering or even talking about the mascots. Why did you feel that way?
Yeah, so I'll just be honest and say that I was one of the Native people who would consider the Washington NFL team's name and mascot, and then also a number of other professional and college sports teams that use Native team names and mascots, to be prejudiced and offensive and even sometimes racist. But it was also not really the kind of thing that I thought should be like at the top of the Native agenda, if there could be such a thing. You know, I was someone who was of the mind that Native people fall to sort of the bottom of every statistical category of misery in this country. And that there are, you know, we had bigger fish to fry, basically, I guess, was sort of my general attitude about this issue. And then I moved to DC 3 years ago. And, you know, I'm a journalist, I do some reporting. And I was surrounded by that umber buffalo nickel head logo, and saw lots of people wearing, you know, the team's memorabilia. I still see people wearing, you know, jerseys and hats and all that sort of stuff. And it just felt like it was everywhere. And I'll be honest, and I'll say that like a lot of, you know, folks here who are Washington fans are also, you know, people of color. My hope would be, you know, we could have an honest conversation about race and racism and imagery and, you know, things that are tied to histories of oppression and colonization and all that stuff. But I never knew how to have that conversation. I never knew how to, like, you know, if I saw someone on the street, how would you even go about stopping them and you know, saying like, hey, like, I'm not super into this team name and this logo and everything. Like, it brings up a lot of, you know, troubling history and ongoing, the ongoing realities that Native people face in this country for me. And so I finally, you know, as a reporter, I'd basically avoided, because I didn't really want to write about this issue. I'd avoided taking an assignment about it for a number of years. But then about a year and a half ago, I actually got an assignment to write about it for The Undefeated, which is ESPN's race and culture publication vertical. And yeah, sort of tried to start addressing that set of issues for the first time. And, you know, I think that it's really important just for people to understand that the Washington football team name in particular is considered offensive by Native people and also, you know, experts like historians and linguists, because not only it references sort of a stereotypical fact about Native people's, you know, skin color, but also because the term, which I don't use in speech, itself references the scalps that were taken from Native people on the frontier. You know, this is like it's almost as though an activist, actually a Black activist here in DC, who has been on the side of changing the name for a long time, described it to me as though there was like a, you know, a team called the Baltimore Strange Fruit or something, right? Like, that's not the kind of team name that you'd want to have in the NFL. So yeah, I mean, I think that this sort of issue was obviously personal to me living in DC. And a big part of this was actually me sort of coming around to actually being willing to report on and discuss, you know, what so troubled me about the Washington football team and about other Native mascots in sports.
And Julian, you touched on quite a few different things that I'm looking forward to just kind of diving into a little bit more. But I want to pick up on what you just said now, which was about, you know, the insult and the history. And even just how it's even, you know, this reluctance to even say the word, right? I know that a lot of African Americans feel that way about particular words that and slurs that were used against us. Can you just dig even deeper for people who still don't really understand the emotional connection, the emotional impact? What is that impact on Native people when they see that representation used as a mascot? You know, as something that is just, it's a selling point. It's fun for some people. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So, you know, there's been, particularly in the last 10 years, a lot of peer-reviewed studies and research on the impact, actually, of Native mascots, both on sort of views towards Native people, and then also on Native people themselves. And also now some research on what the views of Native people are about Native mascots. And so firstly, you know, one of the troubling things that's been found in peer-reviewed studies is that people who already have the potential for sort of prejudicial views, when they see, you know, a mascot for a team like, you know, the Braves or the Chicago NHL team or things like that, it activates their sort of stereotypical views of Native people. So it can sort of lead to more negative racial bias towards Native people, effectively. So that's sort of the first finding that is, in my view, quite troubling. Obviously, we don't want major sports franchises to be increasing racial bias. I think the second thing that's worth pointing out is that there's been a lot of noise on this, like sort of different polls being released in the media saying, actually, Native people don't care about, you know, the Washington football team name or things of that nature. But the sort of most peer-reviewed and trusted research that's actually been published in journals, not just sort of seeded into the press, has shown that Native people, particularly Native people who identify most with their Native identity, do actually find these team names and mascots to be prejudiced and do not support them. So that's a second really important view, which is just to clarify that, in fact, you know, the folks who have gone out and gotten reliable, real data where they've actually, you know, dug into this this question in a way that is, you know, academic and like actually, you know, withstand significant criticism and can go through peer review and get published, which is really hard to do, shows that Native people don't support this stuff. And then lastly, and this is the one that I think, you know, hit closest to home with me and is actually, you know, having written a little bit more personally about like the impact of being here and the native mascots on my life, and also actually a decision that my mom made, which was she actually turned down a job in Cleveland once, in part because, you know, she just couldn't imagine raising a native kid in a city where the baseball team is called the Indians, whose mascot is Chief Wahoo. You know, I think that the psychological impact that these mascots have on Native people, essentially the summary of the research is that it decreases Native children's self-esteem and also sort of decreases what they see themselves and self-report as viewing as their own potential. So it's effectively, basically, the reasoning goes, and this is actually quite similar to research on, you know, stereotypes that might be present about Black people and the impact that that has on Black children, that, you know, seeing yourself caricatured in that kind of way as a child limits what you can see yourself achieving. You know, you basically, what happens is, you know, you go, well, if society sees me as, you know, Chief Wahoo or whatever, how am I possibly gonna, you know, achieve the things that I want to do in my life? And I think that's really troubling. You know, I think that, imagine, you know, turning on a Sunday, you know, Thanksgiving NFL game, and you're confronted with the reality that, you know, every time the Washington NFL team, you know, scores a touchdown, they're going to start singing Hail to the, you know, R word. And, you know, you might see people in the stands wearing, you know, headdresses and fake war paint, you know, sort of mocking your people's culture. And I think that it's hard for me to see how, knowing that that research exists, you know, any of these teams and brands and also their sponsors and fans, once you are, you know, aware of this reality, how you can still say that, you know, this is okay.
And you reference, you know, there's so much research and there's so much knowledge out there about how harmful, you know, these mascots can be. So with that in mind, why do you think it's taken so long for Washington and other organizations to respond to these concerns that the imagery is harmful?
Yeah, so I mean, firstly, I would say that Native activists have tried basically every conceivable strategy to change, in particular, the Washington football team's name. You know, there have been countless op-eds written about this. There's been documentaries. There's been trademark lawsuits. There's been boycotts. There's been protests. There's been, you know, suggestions of alternative team names. There's been campaigns to actually sort of do a culture jam to suggest that that team name has come into existence. Like, all of the things have been tried, and they didn't work until this year. And so the question that begs is, like, why? What has changed? And I think, firstly, you know, it's really important to acknowledge that the Black Lives Matter movement has sort of catalyzed a moment of national reckoning on questions of racial injustice. And that, you know, I think that this is a really clear illustration of why, you know, people of color need to, you know, show up and support each other. Like, when, you know, Black Lives Matter changes the conversation around policing and racial justice in this country, that actually has benefited now Native people, because it's changed the conversation on, you know, the subject of Native mascots. And then the second part of the story that is a little less rosy is that money talks. You know, the sort of straw that broke the camel's back here was the fact that a significant group of pretty wealthy investors, whose total sort of financial interest totaled over $600 billion, you know, went to FedEx, Nike, and PepsiCo, the sort of three major corporate sponsors of the Washington franchise, with a sort of letter saying that they needed to consider changing the team name and mascot. So, you know, part of the story, I think, is a really positive one about the power of, you know, activism and racial justice. And the other part of it is, you know, the reality that we live in a capitalist society where the people who have the most influence over a lot of things are the people who have the money.
Yeah, and this the point you just made about our interconnectedness, you wrote in your op-ed, "We come from beautiful people, Black and Native. We are most beautiful when we show up for our people and show up for each other. Let's make sure all Black lives matter, and let's change this name." There was also another connection you made between the history of Native mascots and minstrelsy. So this idea of the relationships between our community, can you talk more about what it means to show up for each other in this moment? And maybe just more alliances that exist than perhaps we realize.
Yeah. So, you know, I'll just say that I grew up in Oakland, Oakland, California, which is, you know, a Black Mecca in its own right. There's obviously the history of the Black Panthers originating in Oakland. And I think this might be a little bit less known, but the sort of contemporary Native rights movement also has roots in Oakland and the Bay Area. Not that long actually after the Black Panther Party was founded, a group that was part of sort of the student movement at San Francisco State University, part of what was called the Third World Movement that was pushing for what became essentially actually ethnic studies, sort of split off, the Native group split off and led an occupation of Alcatraz Island beginning in 1969. A little over 50 years ago now, that became sort of a moment that rose to sort of national prominence and focused sort of the nation's attention on questions of broken treaties with Native nations and sort of justice for Native peoples. And so I think the point here is just that, like, you know, there has long been historically, and I think to the present, you know, direct relationships between many Native activists and Black activists. Actually, one of the women who started the occupation of Alcatraz, a woman named Lenita Warjack, who's actually a friend of mine, you know, says that she actually got to go to UC Berkeley because there was a diversity program, and that when she got there, you know, she was talking to other sort of Black students and activists on campus about what they were working on at the time, and that that was actually a big part of her politicization. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot of history of sort of solidarity and sort of things being inspired by sort of Black activism in the Native community. And that, in my view, you know, sort of coming from a place like Oakland, our communities are strongest when we acknowledge those relationships and we aim to strengthen them when we show up for each other. And, you know, I think also that includes sometimes confronting the sort of legacies of moments where maybe Native people participated in anti-Black racism or where we didn't show up for each other. And I think that that's, you know, part of the story of what's happening right now in this country is sort of people thinking about what it really means to, you know, be in solidarity with Black Lives Matter, to show up for Black Lives Matter, and what that means, you know, in particular for Native folks.
And you've mentioned, you know, some of the extreme lengths that Native activists have gone to try to bring awareness to this issue. There have been lawsuits, documentaries, demonstrations. Do you have a sense now that activists see this moment as a victory, or do you feel like it's a little too late?
So I think that, you know, for people who've been working on this issue for much longer than I have, I'll just be very clear that I've come very late to the mascot issue and have mostly engaged with it as a writer and reporter. And, you know, there are people like Suzanne Harjo and many others who have been sort of leading the charge on this for decades. I think that for them, this is a monumental victory. Of course, Dan Snyder, the owner of the team, like in an interview just like a year or two ago, said that they were never going to change the name. And of course, never say never. That day has actually finally come. But I think that there's also, in the conversations that I've been party to and the conversation I've been seeing also on social media and elsewhere, is that this is seen as more of like a starting point rather than like a, you know, a final ending place on this issue. I think that people are, and by people I mean Native activists and Native people who are engaged on this issue, are really focused now on sort of expanding the conversation to other Native team names and mascots, which the research has shown, you know, it's not just the Washington football team. It's all of them that have these negative consequences for views of Native people and also for Native peoples and particularly Native children's views of themselves.
You mentioned the never say never, right? People who said that this would never change, and then the reality that our whole world has changed and a lot of reforms that people thought were never possible or unrealistic are now starting to be implemented in certain places. Can you just, as we end, tell us what's giving you hope right now, if anything?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that on my most pessimistic days, I think about the fact that, you know, this country and this whole sort of society was predicated on the death and elimination of my ancestors. The fact that, you know, the United States in a large way and Canada and many of these other countries were built on the graves of Indigenous people. But then I see, you know, sort of the achievements of, you know, someone like the late Representative John Lewis, who, you know, led a life of, you know, steadfast principles and activism, who, you know, led the march across the bridge and secured voting rights for everybody in this country. I think it's important to point out that it is everybody, not just, you know, people of color. And I, you know, I do get kind of hopeful. I think I also see the way that, you know, Black Lives Matter has measurably actually changed views of racial justice and policing in this country. If you look at survey data from, you know, right now, the views have shifted from where they were just, you know, a few months ago. And, you know, I start to think that things can in fact change for the better, that, you know, justice and progress, particularly I think on racial issues, can be frustratingly slow and, you know, is not always going forward. Oftentimes things can slide backwards. I mean, look at who we have as president right now, but that, you know, sometimes things do actually work, and activism and the media and, you know, the right leaders can actually make a difference for people in this country who, you know, are the descendants of folks who, you know, survived a genocide, folks who, you know, were enslaved, folks who came here from elsewhere and have been discriminated against. And that does make me hopeful. So I'm feeling, despite like the pandemic and everything, I'm feeling like sometimes this stuff that we care about and we work on actually can work out.
Couldn't agree more. Well, thank you so much, Julian. It was a pleasure to speak with you and to read your work. If you're interested in checking out Julian's piece, which we referenced on today's show, make sure you head over to The Undefeated. Julian Brave Noisecat is the Vice President of Policy and Strategy at Data for Progress, Narrative Change Director at the Natural History Museum, and he is also a fellow at the Type Media Center and NDN Collective. Most importantly, he is a writer changing the world with his words. Thanks again, Julian.
Thanks so much for having me.
We want to thank Julian so much for joining us here on Dear Culture. So we're not just having these kinds of conversations on Dear Culture. Our staff at The Griot is committed to delivering thought-provoking discussions across mediums. This week, we posted another episode of The Black Agenda Live, a weekly Facebook show hosted by Dr. Christina Greer, Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, and Dr. Jason Johnson.
For this week's episode, we were joined by W. Kamau Bell, who talked with Christina about the fifth season of his show, United Shades of America, which had its premiere on CNN last week. Their conversation touched on the social unrest happening across the country right now and how people can use their platform and what we can expect this season. Here's Kamau and Christina.
I was very conscious about that. And I remember when you were a little guy, you know, 6, 7 years old, and there was a drugstore near us that we would shop in. And as soon as we walked in the door, the store detective would follow us. I said, be really careful. And I pointed out the store detective because we're always being watched.
I remember that lesson and it sticks with me today, so much so that I'm aware of when I'm in stores, even now as a fully grown adult, where my hands are.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, as a kid, I was aware of it because I didn't want to be arrested. Now as an adult, I've become aware of it because I don't want to be killed.
Tonight's big ups goes to comedian Kamau Bell, host of the Emmy-winning series United Shades of America. In the hour-long docuseries, Bell travels the country as he examines the difficulties faced by its communities. During Sunday's extended premiere, Bell visits white supremacy as he travels to Pittsburgh. Kamau Bell is here with us tonight. Good evening. How are you?
Good.
You decided to launch this season in Pittsburgh, one of my favorite cities with your beautiful yellow bridges and obviously August Wilson. But tell us why it is that you decided to launch in Pittsburgh.
You know, this was always sort of set up as a sequel to the very first episode we did of United Shades, which is where I met with the Klan, much as the chagrin of many people. But I knew that if we were going to go back in and talk about white supremacy, we had to do it in a whole new way. And if you're going to talk about systemic white supremacy as a structure and a system, you could shoot that anywhere in America. But when we sort of did research and found out that Pittsburgh is one of the worst places for Black people to live, that's not a narrative that I think is known outside of people who study this stuff or Black folks in Pittsburgh.
So you launched the show initially in 2016 during quite a polarizing election season. And so in your estimation, where are we 4 years later?
I mean, it's funny when you say we launched in 2016, Barack was in office and the idea of a President Trump was laughable. And apparently it was too laughable because many people did not take it seriously. So it didn't feel polarized at the time. It was the end of Barack's term, but we sort of gotten used to, you know, the birtherism. And many of us were just sure he was going to hand the baton to Hillary. And, you know, she would then hand it to Michelle. And then they'd hand it to which one of the Obama kids wanted it. And we would just keep moving. But, you know, things shifted. So I'm glad we launched then so we could be ready for what's going on now.
Last month, you appeared alongside Portia Williams on Watch What Happens Live with Andy Cohen. And during that interview, you both shared frustrations with white people not understanding the Black experience. And so what are some of the things that white people can do to push the Black agenda forward in your estimation?
Google things themselves.
You are a doctor, Dr. Bell. Yeah, I feel like, true, you know, that's your job now.
That's my prescription. Google things yourself. Uh-huh. I think that, like, you know, I mean, we just had this thing with Juneteenth and I got so many emails and tweets. People wanted me to, like, I got something to come to our virtual meeting and tell us about Juneteenth. And I was like, I'm going to watch the same video that you should watch because my family didn't grow up celebrating Juneteenth. I got mad at my mom. Why didn't we celebrate Juneteenth? She's like, when I was a kid, that was a Texas holiday. We didn't talk about that in Indiana. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a prime example of white people learning about something Black and then sort of just turning to the Black person closest to them or the person they talk to online and saying, tell me about it. When most of that stuff can be Googled, then once you have some context, maybe have a conversation with somebody you know, somebody Black in your life.
Right. Well, my favorite is also always, please tell me and please tell me for free.
Yes, yeah.
That's another conversation we need to get into.
Now, I sort of feel like my job is to talk to white people. I get paid for that. I tell Black folks, just send them my way. I kind of get paid enough for it that I'll take a random white person for free every now and again.
Right. But I think the t-shirt should say, Dr. Bell says, Google this you ask. Yes. So Portia Williams, though, is one of the 87 people facing charges after being arrested on Wednesday during the Breonna Taylor protests in Louisville. So how is her arrest a reflection of the Black experience? And can you sort of broaden it out and talk a little bit more about how that reflects on what you're trying to do with the show?
I mean, I think the great thing about how Portia is being seen right now, because even I was somebody who only knew her through the sort of the Real Housewives community. I did not know that she had this deep level of, but she's related to a civil rights hero, Hosea Williams. She has regularly done activism. And that's one of the great things about social media. You get to see people in more than one dimension. And I think that no matter what you're doing as a Black person, you don't feel responsible to your community if you're not checking in, paying attention, and then getting to a level of privilege, using that privilege to shine a light. She's been on this Breonna Taylor thing since the beginning. We have to really understand that now's the time we use that privilege, and there's more ways to use it than just sending a check. And so she is out there on the front lines, masked up, but really understanding that when she goes out there, because she is a famous person, and also because a lot of people just know her for the reality show stuff, she's bringing people to this work that wouldn't get to it otherwise. So I think she's doing a great job out there.
And I think that that's a really important connection. So what can we look forward to in the fifth season of United Shades of America, which, by the way, premieres tonight at 10 o'clock on CNN? So what's something that we should be looking forward to?
Well, tonight is about white supremacy. We have an episode about reparations that we filmed in New Orleans. Nicole Hannah-Jones and Branford Marsalis are in that episode. We have an episode about the gig economy, which is, you know, and how the gig economy is not fair and equitable and certainly affects Black and brown folks get screwed by the gig economy a lot. You don't get benefits. Right now, we taped it before COVID, but we already talk about how they're not getting benefits and they are essential workers. So we have an episode about public schools in Cleveland. A lot of the things that we're talking about right now because of COVID and because of the killing and murder of George Floyd are things that we're talking about in the season. We didn't know. It just sort of ended up that way.
Right, of being Black in America. Yeah, so, we're talking Dr. about being Black in America. Thank you so much for joining the Griot family.
Yes.
So please check out Dr. Bell's new show, or season 5 of his show, The United Shades of America with W. Kamau Bell, tonight. It premieres at 10 o'clock on CNN. Come back and see us, and hopefully we can watch some more episodes and discuss.
All right, again, that was the Black Agenda Live. Make sure you tune in. It's a special series we've been running on Sundays on the Griot's Facebook page. We want to remind our listeners to support and show love to your Black businesses, local organizations, and whatever community groups you support. The business that we'll be highlighting this week is called the Marathon Clothing Store.
This brick and mortar shop, located in the heart of Crenshaw, is the late Nipsey Hussle's fashion brand. Their newest collection partners with Puma, featuring sleek streetwear in memory of Nipsey.
The Griot has published a list of 50 plus Black businesses to support during the coronavirus pandemic. If you'd like your business to be featured, email us at info@thegriot.com. That's G-R-I-O.
Thank you for listening to Dear Culture. If you like what you heard, please give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast. And make sure to share it with everyone you know.
And as always, please email us all your questions, suggestions, and compliments to podcasts@thegriot.com. The Dear Culture podcast is brought to you by The Griot and executive produced by Natasha S. Alford, Rob Dozier, and Kevin Y. Brown. Have a great week.